Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Loveline is meant for an adult audience. Loveline may contain sexually oriented content. Listener discretion is advised. Loveline with Dr. Chris starts.
3, 2, 1.
Now.
All right, y'all. So those that are tracking Dr. Chris's Mercury in retrograde nightmare, I think you'll all sleep better tonight knowing that I got a call from the Mac Hospital, and they're going to be able to save all of the data on my computer. Oh my God. You have no idea how heartwarming that is to hear. I thought I was going to be losing a lot of important things around the computer, including work towards my next two books. I was literally sitting there just waiting for this phone call, and it was going to decide how the next few days of my life were going to go. So anyway, that is handled. Amen to that. Question that is up on our Loveline at GPH. Tonight's question is kind of tied to one of the topics we're going to be talking about later in the show, and it's the impact of increasing the minimum wage. What are your thoughts on that? That's our question of the night. Weighing on that, we'll be breaking that on down. And also later in the show, we'll be talking with Dr. Adi Jaffe for our addiction segment, talking about other ways to quote unquote plan your recovery that are more rooted in a harm reduction model, because total abstinence is not a reliable goal or even realistic for every single person, just depending regardless of what we're even talking about. So we talk about that. And of course, sitting down also with Jarrett Hill doing a little coffee talk. But right now, let's talk about some stuff in the news. Now, we were talking about how T.I. problematically was talking about going into his daughter, who's 18's, gynecological exams to make sure she still had her hymen intact, a.k.a. not a virgin, although, as we talked about, that's not exactly how the hymen works, and virginity is not even a real thing. Well, a bill in New York State is going to be pushed forward that's going to seek to outlaw hymen exams. I think that's freaking phenomenal. A legislator from Long Island, New York has introduced legislation which would prohibit the practice of virginity tests, which are basically, again, medical examinations of the hymen to verify virginal status. We talked about how, you know, the hymen doesn't necessarily tear. It can grow back. Other things can tear it. It doesn't speak to whether or not someone's had sex. And it's also very sexist and, you know, body shaming. So the quote from the assemblywoman, Solanges, she says, across our nation, new conversations are being had about the practice of hymen examinations as a means to discern a woman's virginity. As a member of the Assembly House Health Committee, it's my sincere belief that we must proactively challenge institutionalized misogyny in the health field. The notion that a woman's body can be subject to examination to prove their worth or dignity is an outdated patriarchal concept. Bam! Love that. In addition, the World Congress of Gynecology and FIGO, as it's called, has defined the procedure as invasive and medically unnecessary. So finally, we're going to get some legislation around that. And there's definitely malpractice issues for doctors that are participating in that. I'm glad that's going to be getting outlawed. That's great. Let's talk about a man that was ridiculed for proposing at KFC. So it all started with a tweet from a journalist who tweeted, South African men, because it took place in South Africa, South African men are so broke they even propose at KFC. They have absolutely no class. I mean, who, she said, proposes at KFC? Well, listen, you classist jerk. A lot of people do. Why? Because proposing to someone and marriage is about love, love and commitment, not classism. And also sexism. Yo, people that are identified as female, you can propose, you can pay for the wedding. It shouldn't necessarily fall on certain people's shoulders, right? It's 21st century, step it up. Now, and there's a video of our proposal, go up on our, you know, wearechannelq.com. This is problematic because some people make proposals where they do because of personal history, a personal story, maybe it's an inside meaningful joke. But for someone from the outside to mock the way someone chooses to symbolize their commitment and love to someone, get out of here. Like, that's so offensive to me. Again, marriage is not supposed to be tied to the performative nature of the dress, how much it is, where the wedding's held, how many people are invited. That is us getting lost in consumerism and classism. marriage and relationships should be tied to love, care, and commitment. And that sits outside of when, how, and where you propose and how big your wedding ring is. It's so offensive and problematic when people are mocking the size of a ring, the price of a wedding, how a proposal is done. Seriously, it's so problematic, and you're misusing and bastardizing an institution that already has a lot of issues tied to it. But pull all of that out. And if you don't like the way someone did that, keep your mouth shut. It's such an offensive red flag. So I support anyone who's in a relationship with another that is demanding a certain ring size or a certain amount of money spent on a dress or a wedding. Run. It's a sign that they're devaluing you as a partner. They don't care about love and commitment, and they're trapped in some elitist form of classism and the performativity of a wedding and marriage. And that's not what it's about. So we got to get away from that. Clearly, I have a lot of thoughts on that because I've seen too many people that are amazing people that don't have the money to give what they think their partner, quote unquote, wants or needs. And so it doesn't happen. And again, it's not what it's about. On some more important news, Kesha, she opens up about bisexuality and also her open relationship. I love that celebrities are coming forward with these things because sadly, celebrities are a lot of the people that normalize. They either strengthen problematic things or they weaken them. I don't think we should be looking to celebrities to normalize anything, but they have that power. So I'm glad when they utilize it in a positive way. But she talks about being bisexual and in an open relationship. That's great. Open relationships are healthy. They can exist. Polyamory, whatever it is, we're getting more comfortable seeing these things. Thank you, Kesha, for being so vulnerable and talking about it. Bisexuality as well. I want everyone to be exploring these things because at different times in our lives with different people, we need different things relationally and sexually. And so we want to have access to all of them and have everything pretty much as an option. Coming up next, though, we're going to be talking about really important studies that link suicide to minimum wage. Want to stick around for that? You're listening to Loveline with Dr. Chris on the new Channel Q and radio.com.
Loveline. This is Loveline with Dr. Chris
on Channel Q.
All right, question of the night. It's up on our Loveline IG page. Tonight's question is about minimum wage. What are your thoughts on increasing it? Oh, I can't imagine anyone thinks that's a bad idea, but let's hear about it. Now, why is this an important topic? Well, new piece of research came out. It's pretty compelling. Basically says that there's a simple way to reduce suicides. Increase the minimum wage. So the study showing us, first off, that since 2000, 2001, the suicide rate in the U.S. has gone up about 35%. It's profound. And they're basically looking at what they're calling deaths of despair. And basically that means suicide or death as the result of someone being in a state of despair, right? And it's usually financially driven. So what does that mean? It means that these deaths are the result of worsening prospects among less educated people. And the study was looking at how the solution is pursuing policies that improve the prospects for those working class Americans. Because research has found that when minimum wage in a state increases, the suicide rate decreases. Not necessarily causation, but there's a correlation, meaning that the increase in minimum wage isn't necessarily the cause of suicide rates decreasing, but there's a relationship between the two. There's other factors maybe involved, but they're all connected in some way. So what that means is if we raise the minimum wage by just about 10%, which is a nominal small amount, that it could prevent 1,230 suicides annually. So that's from the National Bureau of Economic Research. By adding 10%, we save almost 2,000 lives. Sounds reasonable to me, because for some people, 10% is adding like $1, $1.50, $2, depending on where, you know, what state you're in. Now, I think it's reasonable because I don't know that CEOs need another car, another summer home, and people under them can't even get healthcare or pay rent, right? We're talking now about how you can't even rent in any major U.S. city a one-bedroom apartment making minimum wage. That's disgusting. Now, the reason why this is all tied together is because if you can't get your basic needs met, food, clothing, and shelter, that is going to lead to a high level of depression. We also live in a classist culture where people think if they don't have the nicest clothing or new clothing, et cetera, that negatively impacts their self-esteem. They feel like they're not a worthwhile person because sadly, in our culture, we don't treat people based on their integrity or their character. We treat them often based on how much money they have, how they dress, and elements like that. And that leads to depression, a lot of suicide. We see that in LA. People that were once wealthy, they lose everything financially. They don't feel like they have any worth or value, and they commit suicide. We see it often. Same thing with people that are aging. Again, they're losing their social capital that's tied to beauty and success, and they drop into depression. They don't feel like they have any value or worth. So again, if we just raise the minimum wage by 10%, we're already saving 2,000 lives. That's meaningful to me, because an increase in 35% suicide around the country is just, that's too problematic. let's talk about some gay stuff. Ellie Goulding, love her. She threatens to cancel her NFL Thanksgiving show because Salvation Army is homophobic. There's a battle going on as to how homophobic the Salvation Army currently is. But she basically was saying she's going to be the NFL show, and that's part of the Red Kettle campaign, which is part of that charity. And her LGBT fans reached out saying, yo, there is such a profound history of homophobia where the Salvation Army has turned away people that were trans, and also national commanders of them have said really homophobic things. So we're getting more information because the Salvation Army is defending itself, saying their homophobic stuff is of myth. But we have research showing otherwise, so we'll keep an eye on that one. All right, coming up next, we're going to be sitting down with Jared Hill from Drop the Subject, because it's Wednesday night, and me and him sit around. We just do a little buddy-buddy talk, you know, keeping it real. Stick around for that later in the show. Dr. Adi Jaffe talking about harm reduction. Listening to Loveline with Dr. Chris on the new Channel Q and radio.com.
Loveline. This is Loveline with Dr. Chris
on Channel Q.
All right, we're back. And so, of course, we're talking with Jared Hill tonight from Drew Up the Subject.
What up?
What's going on?
At 10 here on Channel Q.
That's right, Channel Q family.
Chris, I have a question for you this week.
Yes, a little coffee talk, a little coffee
talk. So, I recently had a situation where, I'm not going to get into like the specifics of the person or whatever, but I swiped right on someone that I know on Tinder. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. But it took me a long time to swipe right, because I was like, I know this person, we're kind of colleagues, but we don't technically work together, and all this different stuff. And so I swiped
definitely right attracted, though.
Yeah. I was like,
okay.
Huh, okay. So I swiped right, and like, that was a couple of months ago. Oh. So I thought, oh, well, apparently he swiped left, and it's nothing. Like, I didn't think about it. But then we matched, and I was like, oh, this is interesting. Mind you, it was the day that I deactivated my Tinder account. I was like, I just turned off all my notifications. I was like, I just don't want to be on Tinder for a little while. So anyway, I got to thinking, and I was like, oh, but because we're kind of colleague-y, what happens if we go out and it doesn't work? And then it's like that weird, like, we used to date kind of thing, or we went out on dates. So the question,
what if we both have to act like healthy adults around each other?
Exactly.
Oh, yeah, it's very difficult.
Which is not difficult for me. I'm friends with almost all of my exes, but it's weird for people.
It is.
And so my question was like, it's easy to transition from, well, easier, I would say, to transition from friend to like date, lover, whatever you want to call that. But it's a lot harder for people to transition back after that if it doesn't go well.
Okay, so 1,000 things come up for me when you say this, because one, I have, I pay for the extra Tinder upgrade, whatever it is, so I can see who swipes right on me.
Oh, is that how that works?
Yes. And then I
just, Tinder, I'm not giving you this $19.99.
I do. You know why? I just work off of that.
Okay.
Because I work from the pool of people that have already swiped right on me. And so I'm constantly encountering friends that have swiped right on me, and I'm not interested in them, and I'm like, oh, look at you. Okay.
Oh,
look at you. I see how you feel, you know what I mean? So I had those experiences. And then I also wrote an article, and I've talked to some people in my practice about the fact that after, in hookup culture, and this ties into what you said, in hookup culture, there's a lot of post-sex shame where instead of smiling and going up and saying hi to someone that you just had sex with, there's anxiety around acknowledging them out in the world, but you built a relationship.
What is that anxiety about, though?
I think it's sex shame.
Is it like vulnerability?
I think it's vulnerability. I think it's sex shame. I think people are afraid to acknowledge to themselves and that person and whoever may ask that's how I know you. And it's this odd boundary where you can come into someone's home, ask them about maybe the decor, have sex, and then they leave, and that's acceptable and comfortable. But then you see them at the gym or out at a coffee shop days later, and there's just a lack of acknowledgement that, like, I know you deeply. So I think it's all about us struggling to hold people in our lives in different roles, and also it's hard for us to acknowledge changing and shifting boundaries, because I've had people where we were friends, then we were sexual, and then we went back to friends, or all different kinds of dynamics, and there's very much a struggle. But I think we have to get better about it, because there's so many different ways to relate to someone, and I want us to have access to all of them. Where I was on a date a couple weeks ago, and I made some reference to friends and sex, and they were like, well, then they're not your friends. And I was like, that's not true. true. I've had sex with my friends.
Because for some people, like, the idea that you've had sex with this person means that they're a romantic partner. And it's like, no, I can have, like, a casually sexual relationship with a person that is not romantic.
Sure. And that sex can come in and out of what's possible, where maybe sex is on the table sometimes, not other times. So long story short, yes, it can be difficult to go from a romantic possibility with someone to go on a date and then realize it didn't work for you or the chemistry isn't there in the way you thought or hoped. Mm-hmm. And then you transition back to friends and each of you have to comfortably, confidently mm-hmm. fall back into those roles. It's hard for some people.
I guess the other question is then, like, what happens when you kind of start going down that path with someone and then you don't want it anymore? And then they're like, oh, that's fine.
Yeah.
But you're like, you're clear it's not fine.
Yeah.
And then they're kind of like resentful or something, but like you're still friends. I feel like they're, I don't know how that works. Like, I'm the guy that I went out with. We had a really great date. So maybe we'll go out again. But like, I think I'm worried about these things down the line.
Yeah.
Like, what do you do in that scenario? It's scary.
It's scary, yes. Because there's an energy with which that person who's still interested in you but is claiming their cold friendship that they still weave into their interactions with you, where they're constantly almost carrying a feeling of like disappointment because they're wanting more when you're spending time together, or they act very triggered and uncomfortable when you're discussing other people maybe you're interested in.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like it's really frustrating when that happens, because then you ultimately want to, you want to acknowledge, like, listen, I'm getting a vibe from you here and I don't really know exactly what you're giving, but like, I feel awkward about the fact that you continue to address me as if we're kind of together or you want us to be together. It's an awkward thing.
So tonight I'm talking with Jared Hill and we're doing a little relational coffee talk, as it will.
Coffee talk.
And one of the things I say to people though is like, if you're going to be someone's friend, then be their friend.
Yeah.
Be prepared to hear them talk about their sex life, their romantic life. And if you can't, that's okay. But don't then say I'm here to be your friend, because you're needing specialized boundaries and you have to kind of own that.
Yeah.
And I don't know what label that is, because we don't of labels for all the ways people can be in someone's life. But if someone says to me, like, I'm cool being your friend, then I expect me to be able to say to them, I went on a date last night. Let me tell you all about it and show their picture, and that they're going to calmly sit there and lovingly engage me around it.
Yeah.
And if you can't, let me know. And then I'll either decide if I can have you in my life at all or whatever it is.
I have an ex I was like that with for a long time. We became friends, and then I was always really good with us just being friends. But then whenever like someone else would get introduced into the picture, I would notice like, oh, maybe I'm not over this. Maybe I do still feel like a little something about this. It can be difficult.
And that's when I pull myself out, right? Like with my ex, we were trying to be friends and I would get a little uncomfortable about certain topics. So I said, you know what? I feel like I'm going to take more time away because I want to be able to be fully present in your life, or I need to take time away because I don't want you to have to censor what you share. And I don't want relationships where I feel uncomfortable and triggered.
Yeah.
And so I want people to do the same thing. Like if you're going to be in someone's life, be present fully. And when they talk about who they're dating, lean in and support that and give them great advice. And if you're uncomfortable or triggered by that, say, you know what? I'm not there yet. And so I'm going to pull myself out of your life. I'll circle back when I'm ready, because I don't want to make you uncomfortable. I don't want you to hold certain boundaries with me. I don't want you to censor what you're talking about.
It's a mess. Just being fully transparent, I'm just coming out of that with my most recent ex.
Okay.
We went through this period of like, we're not together. We're just going to be friends. But like the lines were still very blurry.
Yeah.
And at least I felt they were. And we'd gone through a relationship with a lot of mixed messaging. And so then to continue that in friendship was really difficult. And I got to a point where I was like, listen, we can't talk. Like, we just need to not communicate.
Yeah.
And after a little while, we interacted again. And like, it's been pretty positive. But like, I needed some time to just like not have you in my purview every day or in my text messages. And like, you know what I mean? I need to unfollow you for a little bit and like not see you. And now we're in a good spot. I'm also like, but we haven't crossed the what happens when another person comes in.
But that's the powerful test of how over them are you or are you not yet, right?
Yeah.
Because relationships shouldn't be ones that, we shouldn't have relationships that make us feel bad. They should make us feel better, at least neutral.
Yeah.
And so if you're realizing I'm not sure I can hear that from them, then maybe you still need some time away.
Yeah, I don't know.
That's a good test.
I haven't crossed that bridge yet.
And also for me, I forced myself with my most recent ex to hear it and to tolerate and to deal with it when they were talking about dating new people, because I wanted to be forced to get over it. And so I would lean in and say, you seem really excited. Here's what you should do and blah, 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 blah. So Jarrett Hill, where can people find you?
People can find me everywhere on the social medias at Jarrett Hill, two R's and two T's. And you can find me weekdays on Drop the Subject with Jarrett and Allie right here on Channel Q every day at 10 o'clock.
It's an all right show. It's an all right show.
You know what? When you were on it, you were like, oh my God, this is my favorite show.
Coming up next, we're going to be sliding into those DMs. You're listening to Loveline with Dr. Chris on the new Channel Q and radio.com.
Loveline. This is Loveline with Dr. Chris
on Channel Q.
All right, we're back. We got our question tonight up on our Loveline IG page. Tonight's question is about raising the minimum wage. What are you guys' thoughts about that one? Can't imagine anyone has an issue with that one. But I was looking at this article before we get to the DMs, and it was really funny because I keep hearing this pop up, and it's about how on most airlines, the water's unsafe. And so they're saying avoid coffee and tea and even washing your hands. And I just flew a week ago, and I sat down on an airplane, and I had a little plastic baggie with all my sanitizing wipes. And I was sitting there wiping down literally everything on the seat and around me. Just seeing the looks on people's faces. And I was like, haven't you guys seen this article? Because this one has gone around, and it basically makes you think that on an airplane, you should touch nothing. Because apparently, there's no regulatory mandates around what has to be sanitized. And the people that come on to clean it get anywhere from 3 to 7 minutes. So anyway, I was just looking at an article about that on the break. So it's like we have to basically wear a hazmat suit on an airplane. Touch nothing. All right, time for the DMs.
Sliding into the DMs.
Sliding the DMs is brought to you by our friends at Trojan Condoms because it's a big old sexy world and we want you to explore with confidence. Here we go. Hey, Dr. Chris. So I'm pretty aware of your stance on addiction and how addicts need support and connection. But what steps would you suggest for someone to take when a family member refuses to get help? No matter what we do, he keeps relapsing, and he went from acting like he wanted to get better and accepting the resources to now saying he doesn't even have a problem and can use in moderation. Moderation for him is drinking and driving, getting fired from jobs, trips to the ER, and passing out in public. What should you do when an addict refuses to get help and lives at home? A couple things. Number one, everyone's journey to sobriety is not linear, meaning a straight line. Some people's, it's going to be a circle back and forth. You have to be willing to accept that. So my first answer is you got to let go and let this person go on their journey. You want them to be sober, but if they don't, nothing can happen. I promise you as a therapist, people think that we can force behavior change on people. We can't. You can't make anyone change. You can provide reasons to change. You can talk about the impact things have on you, but you can't make someone change who isn't ready or wanting to change. So you have to let go. Their journey might be one of making incremental steps back and forth, but when someone is not ready to make a change, they're in the what we call contemplation or pre-contemplation stage where they don't even have it on their radar, or maybe they're open to just talking about it. They're not ready to take action. And so all you can do is keep them from getting worse than they already are, which means don't kick them out. You don't want them homeless. That actually makes it worse. Let them have a place to stay, but set some boundaries about how they interact with you. You can say something like, when you're high or drunk, we don't want to be around you, so go to your room and do that. But yeah, you keep providing them a somewhat of a safety net that, you know, letting them hit rock bottom does not promise that they're going to get sober or clean. It does promise that their situation gets worse. So set boundaries, but you got to let go. You really got to let go. So detach a little bit lovingly and let them be on their journey again, which isn't always towards complete abstinence. Some people will always have drugs and alcohol in their lives to some extent. So moderation might be what he needs. All right, sliding their DMs is brought to you by our friends at Trojan Condoms. It's a big old sexy world. We want you to explore with confidence. Coming up next, we're going to be talking with Dr. Adi Jaffe, funny enough, just literally about the topic in that DM, harm reduction. Listening to Loveline with Dr. Chris on the new Channel Q and radio.com.
Loveline. This is Loveline with Dr. Chris
on Channel Q.
All right, we're back. And tonight we got Dr. Adi Jaffe with us, founder and CEO of Ignited. How's it going?
Good. So great to be back, man.
Yeah, thanks for coming back to join us. So this is really important. You know, Loveline has historically really focused a lot on addiction and this kind of 2.0 version. We've been a little, you know, more sex and relationship heavy. So thank you for being part of the family and helping us break down some addiction topics. So something I wanted to talk about tonight, and we talked a little about this last time you were on, but I wanted to kind of zero in more, was that some people come into my practice or even on social media and they realize for themselves that sobriety, or at least initial sobriety, isn't really going to be a goal for themselves or something that's doable. So I wanted to talk about other methods of recovery, not just harm reduction, but I guess some of the things that fall under that umbrella.
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, I want to congratulate and honor anybody who's on that path that you're talking about, right? Because you know this in your practice and the work that you've done, that people use these substances, they use these behaviors to cope primarily. Every once in a while, you find somebody who's just kind of gotten pulled into a lifestyle that they end up not liking. But just the recognition that you want that to change, I think, is a massive, massive accomplishment. So that needs to be honored by itself.
Beautiful.
I think, first of all, there are so many ways of changing that behavior that don't fall even at all in what people consider kind of like recovery and addiction work, right?
Right.
So when you talk about harm reduction, I'll tell you honestly, so I lead a 21-day habit reset challenge that helps people change their habits. Has nothing to do per se with addiction, but more than half the people come for drinking. One of the quickest tips that I give people all the time is it's all about replacement. You know, we keep being told that we should stop the drinking, we should stop using the substances. But there's a big body of literature, and if there's time, I'll tell the story of how I came to discover this in an academic conference. Mm-hmm. But research on interventions shows us we're really bad at stopping ourselves from doing almost anything. Stop yourself from eating junk food, stop yourself from watching a lot of TV, stop yourself from surfing the web all the time on your phone or you're checking Instagram. We're not great at stopping ourselves from doing something. We are so much better at getting ourselves to do something else instead. And that doesn't sound to people like treatment, but there are a lot of really easy kind of starting point methods to get yourself to just adjust and shift your drinking habits, let's say, if that's what we're talking about.
Okay, because let me just pop in right there a second, because I like what you're saying in that you're using the word replacement, and I very much appreciate that. And the kind of words I've used sometimes with some people is crowding out the bad with some of the good.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So true. So for instance, like one of the things I tell people all the time, and you said crowding, I love that, because the example I give people is load up your fridge with other stuff you like to drink.
Okay.
I remember one of my clients once, we literally, you know, people are told you should drink water, et cetera. My wife loves drinking water. Some people find water boring.
But like, then they like tell me. Okay, like me. I'm that one.
Yeah, like you. I put at least like vitamin C stuff or whatever in my water, so at least it tastes like something, because I can't stand the bland taste of water. Now, I can have judgment about that. We can talk about it all you want. But the point is, when somebody's trying to stop drinking, I tell them, go to the market, go to the soft drink aisle, buy anything you love. Just buy a whole bunch of stuff that you really, really like drinking. And then pack up your fridge with it. At least that way, when you open up your fridge, you've got all these other options of things that you like. So that's one thing I love. It's literally crowding out the alcohol with non-alcoholic stuff.
Okay.
So that's one pretty simple option. The other thing, and when I teach people on habit replacement, that I tell them is the thing you put in place of what you're trying to change has to be essentially of equivalent effort and easily accessible.
Equivalent effort and easily accessible. Got it.
Yeah. So like some people say to me, well, when I want to drink, I should go to the gym. I go, well, do you have a gym at home? And they go, no. How far is your gym? It's 30 minutes. I go, you're not going to say to yourself, I'd like to have a beer, but instead I'm going to get dressed, get in the car, drive to the gym for 30 minutes, work out, and come back.
Well, and what I like about what you're saying there, and tonight we're talking to Dr. Adi Jaffe about, you know, other methods of recovery. What I like about what you're saying is what I've seen historically in some recovery programs is this whole shaming perspective of, well, you didn't complain about 30 minutes when you were trying to, in the snow, barefoot, get crack. And it's like, perhaps not, but this is still a very different scenario now that you're not using that. And we want to find things that are sustainable.
It is. You know, there's this saying in the rooms that, you know, we tried all the easier, softer ways, right?
Right.
And the idea, I love this, actually, one of my friends in recovery said this to me once, and it was so good. And he's in 12-step recovery. But the saying is, you know, that easier, softer ways don't work. And he said, that is not at all my experience. I tried every easier, softer way there was, and it slowly edged me to what I now consider my recovery. The reason I think this is such an important thing for people to understand is if you look at real success in the world, and I forget recovery for a second, big term success. I don't know, Amazon, Apple, you know, all the companies you think of who do well, and athletes that work a lot and do incredible work. Success is iterative. You try things. Some of them work, some of them don't. You keep the ones that work and you keep trying and you keep gathering more and more things that that work until you, as you mentioned, crowd out the bad with the good, right?
Right.
The idea that these little steps, I call it the 1% principle, the idea that these little steps that are accumulating towards positive recovery in your life don't matter because they haven't achieved perfect success, to me, is one of the downfalls of the entire way we think about addiction. And I'll give an example. I had a client who was, he was a gay white man, grew up in Texas in the like 70s and 80s. And if there was a time not to be a gay white little boy in Texas, I think the 70s were probably one of those times. Couldn't talk about it, didn't, you know, fought it his whole life, found alcohol. Again, was really anxious and had a lot of issues around that, but found alcohol around the age of 13, started drinking a lot. It was the only way he could fool around with girls, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. By the time he came to me, he was a daily blackout drinker.
Okay.
Had been to multiple rehab centers before, outpatient and inpatient. And as soon as he would leave the centers, he would typically relapse within days. Long story short, we worked together through this online program that I have. And he gets to the point where he sends me this email and he says, oh my God, it's been going so much better. In the 6 months I've been in the program, I've only drank four times. And two of them went exactly as I wanted to, but two of them I drank more than I wanted. And so I shared this on social media, not with his name, obviously,
right,
but I shared the results. And I was like, oh my God, I'm so excited for this guy who just had this amazing success. And I got so many hateful comments suggesting, saying something along the lines of, are you telling alcoholics that it's okay to drink? And the notion that these people took, I mean, 3 to 4 months in a program, figure that's 100 and some days, right?
Yes.
This guy drank on 4% of the days that he was with me.
All right, when we come back, we're going to be talking more about harm reduction with Dr. Adi Jaffe, and you're listening to Loveline with Dr. Chris on the new Channel Q and radio.com.
Loveline. This is Loveline with Dr. Chris
on Channel Q.
All right, we're back, and tonight we're talking with Dr. Adi Jaffe about addiction, and we're really looking at it through a harm reduction lens, and that means that for some people, the goal isn't going to be complete abstinence. It's got to be centered around some form of healing, some form of increased happiness, just some form of improved life quality that's still positive change.
Yeah, and so what you're saying, which is you kind of termed it harm, other versions of harm reduction, I think we have to start looking at things as any improvement is improvement.
Correct. I agree.
Period.
I agree.
You know, if somebody goes from 30 days of drinking in a month to 20 days of drinking in that month, that's wonderful. You know, if that's part of their goal, that's a win. We have to stop this idea. And this is something that's propagated, I think, in our society in general, that if you're not at the top of the heap, if you didn't score 100, then you failed.
That's right. Yeah, I agree. I agree. And you know, our job is just about healing, and that's going to look different for different kinds of people. And, you know, what we're talking about tonight is so highly controversial because I know I was never taught any of this in school. This is nothing that ever came out of the addiction centers I worked in. But
yeah.
I agree with you that had this model been more accessible to just clinicians and treatment centers, I think we would have done more profound work. Dr. Adi Jaffe, where can people find you?
DJaffe.com is the easiest place. I have a podcast, Ignited. It's IGNTD. You can find us at IGNTD.com.
Beautiful. Now you're part of the Loveline family, so we'll definitely have you back. You have an awesome night. Thank you so much.
You too, man.
All right,
have a good one.
And it's time for some celebrity rehab. So, of course, we got Nick Moore with us, Loveline's celebrity guru. What's going on in Celebland?
So, Dr. Chris, it was actually really a slow week in celebrity news. Like, I honestly, it was really hard to find, like, a good thing to even let you know that
okay.
you would need to know. But I love these posts that E! Online actually posted about celebrities praising their significant others right before the People's Choice Awards. You had Chrissy Teigen talking about how John flew and, like, changed his entire flight schedule just to spend 24 hours with her. You really see these nice, lovely Hollywood couples in a world where, like, I feel like we have a failed relationship in Hollywood every other day.
Yes, we do.
So you know, that's giving me some really nice hope right now, but I wanted to know, what's your advice for maintaining and growing love after the honeymoon phase is over?
Yeah, I love this question. It's one of the things that I think is more important for couples to learn is, you know, what are the things we can do to kind of maintain love, connection, eroticism, romance, right? You know, because those are the things that make a romantic relationship extra intimate and close, where platonicness, whatever that's going to mean to you, it doesn't necessarily have, it can for some people, because it's okay to have sex with your friends. And I know that's a very controversial statement, but again, we have to live outside the binary of we're either friends and it's non-sexual, or it's sexual and it's therefore romantic. Like, there's so many ways in between that to relate to each other. But more to my point is that relationships that don't have any kind of romance or affection or sexuality or sensuality, they're missing out on these resources and tools. And so the couples that is possible for them, oh my gosh, utilize that. The number one profound thing I remind people is eroticize your partner every single day. And those that are familiar with my work have heard that to nauseam. But eroticize your partner every day. Keep that sexual erotic bridge built. Don't let it drift. And again, it's a really simple thing to do, because that could mean hugging them, kissing them, leaving them a love note, sexting them, sending them a cute text, buying them something, having sex, making out, whatever it is. But every single day, make sure you've done something that falls under the category of erotic, romantic, sensual, or sexual, to keep that in there, to keep that at play, to not let this relationship ever become more roommate style or base, because that can happen. And it's really hard for some couples after a certain length of time to really re-eroticize each other. And so don't ever let that go. Always remind yourself, this isn't my friend. This is my romance partner. And so keep those pieces always accessible and at play. And that's the number one thing I say. And if you do that, you are ahead of the game. And that will also be a really beautiful buffer when the times are tough, that you've started the day that way, or you've ended the day that way, or you've built that into the midday. That will shave off the sharp edges of other things that are happening in your relationship. So utilize that, maintain that from the door. It's a beautiful resource. All right, question of the night. It's coming up next. Question of the night tonight is, what is your opinion on raising the minimum wage? Oh, you guys are going to have thoughts about that one. So be breaking that on down later. Listen to Loveline with Dr. Chris on the new Channel Q and radio.com.
Loveline
with Dr. Chris
on Channel Q.
All right, we're back. Students stage a walkout after a Catholic high school allegedly threatens to out a gay classmate. Ready for this one, y'all? Oh my gosh, it never stops. So there's this high school senior, and she's one of two openly gay students in the school, the only other one being her girlfriend. So it's the two of them, God bless. So basically, the school tells them, and this is kind of involves the counselor, the school psychologist, which is really disheartening, that they can't sit next to each other at lunch. This rule does not apply to straight students, and she was told that if she won't comply, that they would out her to her parents. I can't quite put those pieces together. I'm not clear as to what their thinking is. I would love to know what they were trying to defend or promote in saying that these two girls can't eat lunch together, and if you don't separate yourselves, that we're going to tell your parents you're gay, but yet anyone else who's dating is allowed to sit together. More powerfully, though, the classmates found out about this, and the next day, to show their support, they staged a mass walkout. And one student said, I didn't agree with the administration, how they helped out the situation, and we wanted to, as a student body, stand and show our support. More of that. You know, protest has been a powerful tool of change since the beginning of time, and I'm all here for it. You got to do that. Just because those that are in power are making decisions doesn't mean it's right. You know, laws aren't always just the decisions made at the, you know, higher levels of the educational system doesn't mean that it's, you know, correct. And so y'all got my support. You got to do things like that sometimes. So take the power back. You know what I mean? Man, the homophobia that exists is just powerfully disappointing at times, especially in the school system, which is a space where people spend a lot of time and trauma can occur and they need a lot more support. So more work to be done. The school, do we have the name of the school? Yeah, Bishop Amit Memorial High School. Y'all, step it up. This is here in California. Those at Bishop Amit Memorial High School. 8 hours or more in school. Y'all need to step it up. We're calling you out. All right, y'all, time for question of the night.
Question of the night.
Tonight's question was pretty basic and straightforward. It's your thoughts on increasing minimum wage. And as we spoke about earlier in the show, the reason why this is really an important topic is because it's being tied to the 35% increase in suicide rates. And a really powerful study, two of them, are showing that it's due to financial stressors, angst deaths, as they're calling it, and that's leading to a lot of suicide. And so raising minimum wage would not only decrease suicide rates, but it would also help people get things like, I don't know, their basic needs met. So what'd y'all think? Someone said no real difference when they also increase the taxes taken and living cost. Bam. Something to think about. Someone else said do it as far as raising the minimum wage. Someone else said each city should at least raise minimum wage to a living wage. Agreed. Agreed. And when you look at the people that are higher up in the, you know, corporate companies with the multiple cars they have and the vacations, it's not even necessarily something that's going to be that powerfully impactful on them. But I don't feel bad about someone having less cars or less trips and fancy vacations so that others can actually get their needs met and have health care. Right. Someone else that needs to be higher and rents need to be cheaper. So we don't need three jobs to pay rent. Truth. Working multiple jobs and still not even able to get their needs met. I know. And people try to say it's laziness. If you just worked harder, you can have whatever you want. That's not how this country works. It's quite classist, racist, homophobic. It just doesn't work like that, right? People are working very hard and still not able to get their needs met. As we're hearing some chuckles in the studio. someone else said, yes, please. It's hard living on minimum wage, even for a one household person. Agreed. I can't even imagine. Someone else said, and I make over minimum wage, and you're still agreeing. I agree. Someone said, I think the fact that I live in one of the cheapest cities in California and can't afford a one bedroom is ridiculous, and I make over minimum wage. Agreed. It's ridiculous. It really, truly is. Someone else said, raise the minimum wage. It's essential. Current minimum wage rates in the U.S. and Canada are a human rights violation. Well said. It really is. It's a human rights issue. It's, as I said, 35% increase in depression. I'm sorry, in suicide. Just raising it by 10%, the study showed, would reduce and save 2,000 lives. 2,000 lives saved, 2,000 less suicides. That's powerful enough for me. Someone else said, as far as raising minimum wage, yes, and more employers need to take people on full-time so they can get those benefits. Blam! Someone said, raise it to $20. All right, I'm here. Someone else said, are they going to raise the wage for the rest of us? Someone else said, how can we lower the cost of living? It's a good question. It's a good question. Capitalism. It's problematic. Someone said the minimum wage should be raised every few years according to inflation. Agreed. Someone said people at McDonald's wanting a raise when EMTs and fire suppression aides make $15 saving lives. Everyone should get a raise. Someone else is saying it's long overdue. As far as raising minimum wage, someone said do it and make it livable. Yep, it's all about the livability, right? Raising, if it still doesn't help people or increase their quality of life, it's not necessarily a true intervention, right? Someone else said it should have been done years ago. It's true. Someone else said, please do, because the being poor isn't cute. It's difficult. That's right. Struggle. And running multiple jobs isn't always even doable. If you have childcare responsibilities, and they're talking about shortening the school week and having kids leave school earlier. And some of the people that are working all these multiple jobs to take care of their children are saying, how is that going to impact me, right? I'm already struggling with getting my needs met. Now I have childcare issues because the school week has been shortened, which I support the reasoning behind it, but it's going to impact lower socioeconomic families. And so they're going to have to pick up the slack somehow. Oh my gosh, a lot of work to be done, y'all. But thanks to those that participated. Important question to talk about, especially when we're looking at the impact on mental health. And of course, it's always tied. Income is directly tied to mental health, right? We can't expect people to have lower rates of anxiety and depression if, again, they're not able to eat, find housing that supports the amount of people that are in their household, et cetera, et cetera. Coming up next, we'll be sliding into those DMs. Listening to Loveline with Dr. Chris on the new Channel Q and radio.com.
Loveline
with Dr. Chris
on Channel Q.
All right. We're back. Did you know our show is podcasted? We are channelq.com. We got all the episodes up there. Check it out. You can go back and listen to old ones, share them, binge listen. But guess what? Time for some DMs.
Sliding into the DMs.
Sliding the DMs is brought to you by our friends at Trojan Condoms. It's a big old sexy world. We want you to explore it with confidence. Here we go. Hey, Dr. Chris. I have social anxiety. And when I have a date planned, I get super anxious. Sometimes I get so anxious about a date that I have a hard time living my normal life. I can have so much anxiety about a date that for the days leading up to it, it's hard for me to go to work, to see friends, or just take care of myself, like brushing my teeth, eating, and doing laundry. Usually I end up canceling the date because of the anxiety. Do you have suggestions for baby steps I can take? Yes, I sure do. So I think for some people that might have, like you said, social anxiety or, you know, anxiety around confidence and difficulty around intimacy and closeness, or more importantly, it's the newness. Usually what triggers it is possibly a self-esteem issue, or it's that there's a lot of anxiety around sitting with someone new that you don't have any kind of relationship to. So it's hard to go from 0 to 60. So what I say to people is you can have mini dates before the actual date. What I mean is I'm assuming you've met them online, because if you've met them in person, it probably has derived more confidence for you. But let's assume you met them online. There's multiple things you can do leading up to that that are ways that you can slowly get comfortable connecting and getting to know this person. So one of the things I tell people is before you meet up with someone you met online, always get them on the phone. Couple reasons. One, it's going to increase your confidence in the connection you have or chemistry, or show you that it's not there. If you have a phone call with someone and it seems very disconnected, very uncomfortable, it's not going well, well, you can guess that the date could be just as bad. I myself have in the past followed that role, got them on the phone, and realized this is not something I'm interested in. Things were coming up on the phone call around a lot of different things. And I was just kind of like, you know what, this really isn't a match. And other times it was the opposite. I was really excited to meet them. I've seen photos at this point. Now I'm talking to them and it sounds really great. It's a pre-date. And that could sometimes start to soothe it, because you've, you know, quote unquote, met them on one hand, even though it's over the phone only. You start to talk to them, you've heard their voice. So do things like that. Get them on the phone maybe a few times, maybe get them on FaceTime. Do small, windowed, contained pre-dates where it's on the phone for 20 minutes, FaceTime for 5 or 10 minutes, texting. Delay the actual first date and do those things first, and it'll build up the confidence and the comfort. You'll get to know them, and that could help produce it. So good luck. Hey, Dr. Chris, do you think it's possible to be cured from mental illness like social anxiety disorder, depression, eating disorders? Or do you think these are things that will always be present for some people and that will need management for the rest of their lives? I'm wondering because you will often hear people with drug addiction say they're in recovery or recovering, but that they will never be recovered. And I'm curious about whether this applies to all mental health struggles. Yes, I do believe with many mental health struggles, that they can be cured. I tend to use the framework of people's relationship to something. I don't talk about addiction. I'll say your relationship with drugs, your relationship with alcohol, your relationship with sex, your relationship with food. And throughout our lives, that's going to shift and change. Because again, we don't always want to look at it as a black or white, like I have a healthy relationship or I'm addicted, or I'm addicted and always addicted. Because as we work through some of the underlying issues that addiction might be a symptom of, that's going to change, but other factors might change your relationship to these things. And so that's why it's always about what is your current relationship with anxiety? What's your current relationship with depression? Because the other piece is that depression's an expected phase of life. We all will be depressed at certain times. That's not bad. That doesn't mean disorder. That doesn't mean we need to get rid of it. A lot of the work around these things is management. We're going to feel anxious. And even if you're taking anti-anxiety, antidepressions meds, it doesn't mean that they're removed. Right? You're still going to feel those experiences, because mental health or being a human is about a full range of emotions and being able to manage all of them. Meds are for those that it really makes their quality of life really low, but that doesn't mean they're not going to encounter those feelings. But overall, yeah, you can absolutely recover from some of these things as you work through what's driving them or you find new skill sets, but it's sometimes your relationship to it might return, but it, you know, can shift. But that's why I don't use recovered or recovering. I talk more about your current relationship to something. It's less pathologizing. Slide in the DMs is brought to you by our friends at Trojan Condoms, because it's a big old sexy world and we want you to explore with confidence. That's our show. We'll be back tomorrow night. Thanks for hanging out with me, and y'all have an awesome, awesome night.